ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is David Twidell. David is the Rebecca Cheney McGreevy Endowed Chair and Professor of Marketing at Emory University's Guizetta School of Business. He's an expert in the areas of customer relationship management and social media analytics. Today, we'll be talking about generative AI images and how they might be deployed in advertising. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
There's a lot of conversation around generative AI, its potential to help make people more efficient and effective, and the ways in which it might disrupt entire sectors. It was a central part of both the writers and actors strikes we saw in 2023. Most people are familiar with ChatGPT and how it can be used in writing, but you did something interesting and started to evaluate how generative AI could be used to create visual assets for brands. First, let's set the stage with the role that visual assets currently play in communicating and engaging with consumers. How critical are the visuals to consumer outcomes like attention and attitude?
The visual component is huge. If you think about how we consume media today, whether it's on a smartphone or a screen, it's often the visual that has that stopping power to grab your attention.
So important. Brands and agencies are already using Gen AI in scripting and vocal AI for voiceover. Are they already currently using Gen AI for visuals?
There's starting to be some work in this space. Some of it was initially kind of light editing, but I think we've seen an entire ad from Coca-Cola that was produced using generative AI. So there's definitely a lot of interest in this space.
Interesting. In my conversation with Martin in December, and with these various experiments that are already going on in the mix, the human is definitely part of it. But my understanding is you were curious if the machine could go it alone or go a long way by itself. Could you talk a bit about that? And what would be the level of human nudge that you were thinking about?
Yeah, so if we back up a step, we're all familiar with generative AI, whether it's ChatGPT or autocomplete from emails and text messaging. And the way that these patterns are identified is saying, let's look back at what we've seen before and effectively recreate those patterns. The challenge that we have, especially when we're trying to apply it to marketing, is I need to create content that is going to resonate with consumers. Just because the text that I come up with looks like coherent English and might be the kind of thing that you can turn in for a book report doesn't mean that it's going to be persuasive, doesn't mean that people are going to see it and be moved to go out and click on a product page, go out and make a purchase. And the same is true of visuals. Just because it's an aesthetically pleasing visual doesn't mean that it's going to be effective at getting someone to click on an ad, holding somebody's attention, keeping that brand in mind for people when they are in the market for making a decision. And so that's what we wanted to look at, was how can we use a degree of human input to, if you will, guide the generative AI?
But it's different from scripting. It's different from the query. The nature of the guide was different, wasn't it? Or was it not?
Absolutely. And if we think about these big models that have been built, whether it's the large language models like ChatGPT or the image generators like DALL-E and Stable Diffusion, and the way that we're used to interacting with these is I provide a specific prompt, right? And based on that prompt that I input, I'm going to get a set of output. These models, these kind of off-the-shelf tools, there is no additional human input that's being provided. And so in many respects, it's you're going to get what you're going to get. What we had done from a visual standpoint was to essentially refine the model to teach it a specific prompt. So we'd said, all right, I want to produce the visual content for a particular car brand. I need to train the model, in a sense, on images from that car brand so that it learns what that car looks like. If I want to produce a luxurious aesthetic in the ad. I need to train the model in terms of what does luxurious look like. And so when we go back and say, put this car in a luxurious setting, that additional training that we've done is going to allow the model to be able to generate the product we want in the visual setting that we're looking for.
So just to be clear for listeners, it's about, and obviously you're training the model to understand this, but it was the exploration is around if this machine can be the creative partner, if they're given specific business objectives, right? Can the system generate something that works? And from the point where they give the business objective, does a human intervene prior to the output? My business objective is X. Machine does its thing. Do I tweak it along the way as a human, or does it generate something?
So as the user of the system, there is no additional tweaking that is necessary. It's saying, I work for this brand. This is my business objective. Go.
Right. Which is pretty amazing. So let's back up a bit. As you were saying about the importance of visual content and also training, visual content that helps consumers move along the sales funnel varies, and brand image varies. And a lot of practitioners do this by feel. They're not necessarily aware of the component parts or how they all fit together. But obviously, if you're training an AI that's an infant and you want them to be able to perform like an experienced practitioner, you need to break it down. So in order for you to even get your project off the ground, what were the different dimensions you had to teach the visual AI to understand, and how much would you say were brand specific?
So in our use case, we started with saying, let's just work on a single brand for proof of concept.
Okay. The
workflow that we came up with, though, we've applied to a second brand just to ensure that it works. And the style of the ads, the visual style is different. That's going to be specific to the brands.
Okay. But
the workflow itself definitely carries over. And I think one of the things that's important for listeners is that where does this data come from that we're using, right? If I'm a brand, if I'm Coca-Cola, I have hundreds, thousands of visual assets that I own already. That data could be used for training purposes. What we had done was to say, all right, we're going to put ourselves in the shoes of an automotive brand. Let's look at existing automotive ads and let's see which of these ads performs best in the eyes of consumers on particular metrics. I had the opportunity, I was speaking with someone from Amazon talking about generative AI earlier this week, and he had come to the same conclusion of, well, even if you don't have this archive of data available to you, you could just test it. We can create a study, put it on the web, test out your digital ads and see which of those ads are the best performing. And that's what plays a critical role in the process that we had developed, is having some source of data, whether it's past performance by the brand's own assets, whether it's survey data, but we need some input that tells us, these are the ads, these are the visual content that perform well. And that's what we use to kind of to train the AI. It's saying, I want you to produce a car ad that is going to build awareness. Well, let's show people hundreds of possible car ads, actual car ads, and have them evaluate which ones perform well on this particular metric. Take the best performing of those car ads and say, this is the visual language that works well to build awareness, or this is the visual language that works well to drive purchase intention.
Interesting. I wonder, certainly when an agency, I create an ad for Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola owns that ad. And yes, it's out in the universe, but if I'm Coca-Cola and Pepsi has an AI, I don't necessarily want them to be able to train off of my advertising. I've invested in that advertising. So it seems like this is new frontier land. Do you believe that there will be some effort to prevent this kind of scraping of competitor data?
Yeah, I think that's a question that's ultimately going to end up in the courts, because on the one hand, as you said, the brands have invested a lot in these digital assets, a lot in building their brand. And as we've shown in this research, as well as some other work that we've done, that's the necessary data for making these models better for future applications by the same brand, not a legal concern, but right, also by their competitors.
So question, let's say I've created the iPhone before an iPhone existed, but I'm the new kid on the block, new thing, mm-hmm, new co. How many images, what kinds of things would, I mean, there are some things like luxury, which obviously it can learn because it's a concept, right? But if, how many images would I need to collect in order to train it?
Not as many as you might think. I think we had a dozen, two dozen images.
Oh my gosh, that's not very many.
of the particular product. And in fact, since we had done this work, I've seen even more AIs developed and kind of that are being promoted, startups that are being built that do a phenomenal job with just a single image.
Oh, wow. You
know, like I saw one the other day that from a single image, it can create motion.
Oh, I've seen that. I've seen the adding of motion to an image. It's really interesting. Question for you, and this is in the material you had written. What are mindset metrics?
So the mindset metrics, you can think of as kind of, I want to know what the consumer thinks and where they are in the purchase process. So think of it as kind of the stages of the purchase funnel, and that there are metrics, there are, you know, kind of standard survey items that we may ask consumers to gauge their level of interest in a brand or in a product, and how close are they to actually making that decision.
Okay, I've got a question that really isn't on your specific paper, but is more of philosophical, I guess, which is, does it matter how the emotional state of the consumer, or is it really, you just need to understand these mindset metrics?
I think it's going to depend on the product itself. If you're dealing with what I'll call non-essential products, I think the emotional state's going to play a bigger role, because that's effectively the context of the purchase occasion.
Right.
Whereas if it's a very utilitarian purchase, kind of a necessity that I've done my homework on already, I don't think that emotional mindset or that emotional perspective is going to be as critical.
Fascinating. One of the things I'm curious about is that all of the AI models are trained on the data. And I've started to notice, certainly with ChatGPT, I can start sort of, there's a similarity mm-hmm, that seems to happen. I can kind of tell when that's an output. Is there a potential that if Coke and Pepsi, we'll just use them as our examples, they've both trained on their own stuff and secretly on their competitor stuff, and they want awareness and brand values, and they're somewhat close. Are they going to end up, if they use similar prompts, end up with similar ads?
That's a distinct possibility. Yeah. And that's one of the questions that we're not able to answer yet, but
right,
you can imagine kind of this scenario that you're describing of, there's going to be a time period where you have some early adopters that are leveraging generative AI. Gradually, I would imagine, because of the potential gains in efficiency, you're going to see more and more businesses adopting this technology. Mm-hmm. But if we all use the same models, trained on the same data, and we don't do anything to create that differentiation, now it's kind of a race to the bottom as far as messaging. So I think
right,
that's going to require that degree of human intervention, at least periodically, to make sure that the content stays fresh, to make sure that your message is still cutting through the rest of that clutter.
Right. Although in the paper, you discuss fluency theory and the beauty in averageness. Can you explain for listeners what those are and how they relate to what level of differentiation is desirable?
Sure. So I had heard the story years ago, and I think it's true, but I'm not 100% sure on it. But the story that was going around was that the face that's used by Betty Crocker, by the brand on their boxes, that face is actually a composite average of, let's call it 100 women of different nationalities and different backgrounds, and they effectively average the face out. And there are a couple of reasons that's going to work. One is there's kind of that trace familiarity that my particular background is in there somewhere.
Right.
It's been incorporated into it. But you can also think of it kind of from a pure statistical standpoint of if each face is a little bit different, right? We can think of those in some sense as the idiosyncrasies. Well, if I take this average and get this kind of composite, it kind of smooths out all of those errors.
Right, right.
And that's sort of what's happening here. We're saying each of these creatives that we've used, that we've trained this model on, there's something about it that is unique to that particular creative. But if I take that composite average and produce an ad that is kind of that, again, that is based on 25 different ads or thousands of different images, what I'm left with, I'm taking out those idiosyncrasies and I'm left with the core of the ad. And because we're saying we're only going to train on the best performing ads for a given business metric, the average of good performing ads is in and of itself a good ad.
Right. And it also, and there's a level of familiar, it's within the neighborhood of familiar, and that's a good thing.
Exactly. And that's the idea of fluency, is we're speaking the same visual language, so it looks familiar to me, and that's going to facilitate the recall of those ideas of that brand in my memory.
Fantastic. So now, in order to compress things and make sure we get to the big reveal, can you explain how the big pieces fit together of what you created?
The tools that we use, these are all available off-the-shelf tools that can be used. But we started with an image generator. Stable Diffusion was the particular one that we used, but there are many more out there now. So, all right, we don't want to start from scratch because that's incredibly time-consuming, resource-intensive, and expensive. So we're going to take an image generator that's already been built. Mm-hmm. We then added to it and say, okay, learn this particular product. Here are pictures of this particular product. We also added to it, here are pictures of good performing ads. And by good performing ads, what we mean is for a specified objective. We want it to be memorable. We want it to increase awareness. We want it to increase interest in the product. And the same picture, the same ads may not do all of those things. So we train it on the product. We train it on the particular business objective. We also trained it on brand personality. We said, here's images that are rugged. Here are images that are luxurious. And so when we're putting together this prompt, what we're able to do is say, give me a car ad, because we've learned the style of car ad for this particular product that performs well on this particular metric and evokes this particular personality. And
so can I ask a quick question? So when you were talking about learning the good ads, were they good car ads or good any kind of ads?
These were the good car ads.
Okay.
And that's an important part, because again, what works well for a car ad might not work well for a cosmetics ad.
Right.
So
exactly.
That visual language is going to be context specific.
Okay.
And regardless of the metric that we used for both ruggedness and luxuriousness as the brand personality dimension, the AI generated ads on average outperform actual ads that were used by brands.
Wow. So they were better. So you do the training, you put in your prompts, and they performed better than ads that had already in the past been generated?
Yeah, that had been produced by people used by brands.
And including competitor advertising? Or did you look at competitor
advertising? We looked at the competitor advertising. We looked at the brand's own advertising. And the AI-generated ads did better than on both of those dimensions. And just to dig into it a little bit, what we really did, and it goes back to kind of that our discussion around averages, what we really did was we essentially chopped off the lower end of the distribution, saying we right. want to train this to make good ads. Well, if we focus on the good ads, we're dropping out all of those ads that didn't perform as well. The part that caught us off guard a little bit was it's about, I want to say, I'm going by memory here, I think it's in the neighborhood of 10 to 15% of the AI generated ads outperformed all of the ads that we used for training.
Wow. 10 to 15% of the AI ads outperformed those ads which had been used to train. That's amazing. That's really something. Now, I touched on this a little bit earlier, and I just want to sort of belts and suspenders pound the idea home. And I'm a totally different type of business. Mm-hmm. What parts of this system would I need to retrain? I have a rugged, luxurious brand, but I am a patio furniture.
Your product, that part needs to be retrained.
Right.
And the good ads in your category.
Right. Okay.
Those are the pieces that are going to have to be retrained.
Was there any text component to your advertising?
Not in this work. We just focused on the visuals. And that's likely the next place that we're going with this is, all right, I've got a visual component. I've got a textual component. I need to make sure those two things work together.
Right. So a cold start, which I touched on also earlier, a cold start for a new brand that doesn't have a series of existing visual materials. How would you talk about good, how would you frame that? How could a company frame good advertising?
That's going to be on looking at what the competitors in your industry have done, both from a textual standpoint and from a visual standpoint.
Interesting. So what's interesting, and you used Stable Diffusion off the shelf, depending on the cost to implement this, the implications to me seem pretty foundationally disruptive. What are your thoughts about that? And what kind of time horizon would you say is out there?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we're starting to see what I think could be a fundamental shift from the perspective of how marketing is conducted. Yeah, if we look at kind of your mega brands like your Coca-Cola's or Microsoft, your big budget brands, I think there always is going to be a desire for what I'll call the white glove treatment in terms of working with your agency. But take smaller and mid-sized businesses that don't have that budget. And marketing is something that they need to do, but especially for entrepreneurs and small businesses where the owner is wearing multiple hats, these tools becoming available saying, hey, your marketing can be potentially automated and made more effective than it currently is. And it doesn't necessarily have to come at a super high price tag. So in an ideal world, I think you're going to see kind of the democratization of a lot of this technology being made available to smaller businesses, and enterprises are going to use it as well. It may be that we decide that, you know what, the cost of campaigns aren't as big as they used to be. So maybe I'm not going to stick with the same campaign for as long if the performance of that campaign starts to fall off. Maybe I change it out for the next campaign because it's not as expensive for us to generate that.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. I think that the cost, though, obviously agencies do more than just produce the ads, the big agencies, but I could see this having an impact in terms of the manpower, person power, staffing it, you know?
Right.
Really, really different. And I mentioned this to Martin when we had our conversation. We did talk around democratization and what this would mean, and also for emerging countries, and that really interesting in that respect. But you have a lot of people who, I think something like 52% of college graduates want to work in a creative field. Do you think that this will sort of change the jobs landscape?
I think there's no question it's going to impact the creative field. I'm hopeful that what it does is changes perhaps the skill set that's used in those careers.
Okay.
Rather than saying we're going to entirely replace the creative team with AI, because all that AI can do is replicate what it's seen before.
Right. It innovates. It doesn't invent.
Right. And that invention, can you use AI to support it? Yes, but you still need someone that's sufficiently creative guiding the AI. And so I would encourage folks that are interested in going into those creative careers to understand how can you use AI as a partner, right? Rather than seeing this as the adversary saying, oh, this thing's going to take my job. It's no. This is going to allow you to do your job better and use it to, what we've seen in a lot of cases is people saying, I want to offload the boring stuff. I want to offload the mundane work. For example, if we're doing video production, well, one of the stages in processing video might be say, all right, I need to cut the video into different scenes, right? Well, that's something that would have to be done manually. That's something that could be automated. So that's just one example of saying, I still need a person being in charge of the creative vision, but I can automate a lot of the supporting tasks that are essential.
Right. Well, I really, what's amazing to me is the performance of the output.
I'll give you one other piece that was not in the paper, and I did not know that my co-authors were running this, but they had just told me about it last week. So in the paper, we had all of the work that we had done was via consumer surveys. And again, consumer surveys are a gold standard for copy testing. Right. But what they also did, they decided, let's run these as digital ads. And let's look at in the field performance, we see the same performance difference with regards to click-through rates that the AI-generated ads are drawing more eyeballs in.
Wow. It's the same percentages?
I don't recall the percentages. I know that it was a statistically significant difference.
Wow. That is so interesting and revolutionary and just mind-blowing. Thank you so much for telling me about the paper and coming on and talking about it. It's really great stuff. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Glad to talk about it with you.
We reached the end of another episode of Up Next. I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time right here on Up Next.